Welcome back to the Europeans, the podcast about this kind of amorphous continent that we live in. Where are its edges? Nobody knows. I'm here, as always, with Dominic Kramer.
And who are you?
I'm Katie. I thought you knew that.
All right, arguing already. yes. And I'm speaking to my friend Katie Lee from Paris, a lovely friend. How is it there in Paris?
It's good. I'm currently buried in mountains of paperwork. One of the things I started doing during our summer break was my application for French nationality, which is very exciting.
That is very exciting. How long might it take?
Forever. I don't know. I was complaining about this to one of my neighbours the other day, and he was like, look, you're trying to become French. You need to be good at paperwork. That's what it means to be French.
So it's like, this is the ultimate test.
The ultimate French test. So that's what I've been doing for the last month, being buried under the weight of my own tax documents. How are you?
I'm fine. Yeah, I'm pretty busy, which is nice and a luxury problem right now. But yeah, it's weird.
Well, we also have a very busy show coming up for you this week. What's going on?
Yeah, this week we are checking in with Hanna Lyubakova, a journalist from Minsk who has been doing some really amazing reporting about the situation in Belarus. I imagine by now, pretty much everyone listening will at least vaguely know what's been happening there with this huge peaceful protest movement following the sham elections back in early August. The protests are obviously still going on, and Hannah's Twitter feed has been one of my go-to resources for following the inspiring and imaginative protests, but also to see the terrifying, brutal, violent response from the state. So we'll be speaking to Hannah a bit later in the show to have a look in more detail about what's happening there. But for now, it's time for
Who's had a good week, Dominic?
I'm going to give good week to Portugal this week after they said goodbye to oil and gas exploration, hopefully for good.
That seems nice.
It does. And I actually think it is. It means that the government will not be giving out any more contracts for fossil fuel exploration. And whilst this ban has yet to be formalised by any legislation, it is actually immediately in effect due to the fact that the final company that had a contract in Portugal to extract fossil fuels, an Australian company, realised that they could not depend on the government's support, and it was easier for them to just pull out of the country mid-exploration, even before the government had formalised their decision.
So just to be clear, this is about looking for fossil fuels on, like, Portuguese soil?
Yes, and then the extraction would follow.
Okay, got it. But like, is this just a publicity thing? Because France did this same exact thing a few years ago and everyone was like, yeah, good job guys, until it turned out that like literally only 1% of France's fossil fuels actually comes from mainland France.
Yeah.
Is this the same kind of like symbolic thing?
That case was particularly questionable with France, because France also announced that they would have no new contracts but allowed the current contracts to run up until 2040. That isn't the case in Portugal. And also, in Portugal's case, it is much more significant than the French example, because this Australian company, who are imaginably named Australis, had been discovering extractable hydrocarbon on Portuguese soil and had made some pretty big discoveries. Mm. The company actually thought that it would have been able to extract enough natural gas to supply the whole of Portugal for 2.5 years.
Oh, wow. That's a quite decent chunk of resources.
It is. And so the fact that the company still felt it had to withdraw from the country despite that potential gold mine shows how unfriendly the Portuguese government had been to these fossil fuel extraction firms. As the environmental campaigners have long been calling for, in Portugal, they are actually going to keep it in the ground.
Presumably, they still do actually need natural gas. Is that a silly question?
Yeah, of course. The people of Portugal, like the people of almost every other country in the world, still are rather dependent on natural gas. So the fact that they are not going to be extracting it on home soil will mean it has to be imported from abroad at higher prices than if they were extracting it themselves. But I hope that it also means it will hopefully accelerate the transition of the Portuguese economy away from fossil fuels. And I think the lesson here is for governments to think ahead and invest now in transitioning the economy to a more sustainable and carbon zero model. Okay, agreed?
I think they heard you, Dominic. I can hear them getting to work right now.
Thank you. It's actually quite amazing how quickly Portugal has turned against oil and gas explorations. Back in 2015, so 5 years ago, there were 7 companies working on 18 sites, and today there are none. And we have to give some of the credit to climate activists and local campaigners who have been fighting tirelessly against these exploration and extraction contracts with protests, direct action, lobbying, anything they could try. In the end, the politicians are also following public opinion, which has broadly soured against oil and gas being extracted, partly for the climate change reasons, and partly because of concerns that oil and gas extraction is not that compatible with the country's vital industry of tourism.
Ah.
One other thing, Portugal are also going to be joining the growing list of coal-free countries in 2021, a few years ahead of their own schedule. So, yeah, this is all part of the picture in Europe that fossil fuels are becoming less and less...
groovy.
Yeah, I was going to say profitable, but groovy is also true. So yeah, fossil fuels are not so dominant in Portugal anymore. And part of that is for environmental reasons. And part of that is because, at least in some cases, it's becoming less profitable to produce all your energy with fossil fuels. And hopefully that trend will continue and renewables will soon be the cheapest way to provide all our energy. In the meantime, good week, Portugal.
Nice one, Portugal.
Who's had a bad week, Katie?
There was really only one choice for bad week this week, and that is the devastating fire at the Moria refugee camp in Greece that has left about 12,500 people homeless. It's still really unclear how the fire broke out, but if you've been following the shambles that is European refugee policy, you probably heard of Moria before. It is slash was the biggest refugee camp in Europe. It's on the Greek island of Lesbos. And it had become really notorious for the inhumane conditions in which people were being kept there. It was massively overcrowded. There were only ever supposed to be about 3,000 people living there, as opposed to 13,000. And because of that, it became really squalid. There weren't nearly enough toilets. There was rubbish everywhere. And now it's burned to the ground. And that has immediately left thousands and thousands of people without shelter. So it's been a really terrible week for these people who were already living in really appalling conditions and have now found themselves sleeping in fields with zero possessions and, in a lot of cases, very little food.
So broadly, what's the response been from European countries who should be helping?
Well, the most obvious question after this disaster is, like, what can be done to rehouse all of these people? So far at the time of recording, the main thing that's happened is 10 European countries have said they'll take in 500 of these people, almost all of them unaccompanied children, which might sound like a start, but as the Politico journalist Zia Weiter pointed out, that is approximately one kid per million Europeans. So hardly qualifies as going above and beyond the call of duty. As for the other 12,000 or so people who are still there and still very much homeless, the EU says it's going to rebuild Moria with modern accommodation, which, firstly, who knows how long that would take? And secondly, like, it's just a reminder of how totally messed up European refugee policy is. Honestly, I don't understand how the situation has ever been allowed to leave the front pages of European newspapers. We act like we are the most civilized people on earth, and yet we have been keeping thousands of people in this giant prison camp for years. And I know there's a lot of other stuff going on right now, but like sometimes I just don't understand why there isn't more collective shame about this. Like, this is being done on our behalf. It is EU policy that is keeping people trapped on this island, and we're just going to rebuild this place.
But what can the EU do if there are certain countries within the EU that will veto any move? Like, you criticize the EU broadly, but obviously something needs to be done, but maybe the EU just isn't set up as an institution to be able to react to something like this.
Yeah, I think you're probably right in that we did try and come up with a quota system. And as you might remember, that fell apart like pretty catastrophically. A few countries, namely Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic, flat out refused to take in their allotted quota of refugees. And there's been pretty minimal consequences for them. I think there was a European Court of Justice ruling in April that they had done something naughty, and now it's up to the European Commission to decide what to do about it, if anything. I think a lot of bureaucrats think it's probably better to try and work constructively with these countries that don't want to get involved in any way, rather than just telling them off. But it also means that some countries just get away with showing no solidarity at all.
The EU are meant to be announcing like their new policy around refugees at the end of this month, I think. I imagine it won't be ambitious enough.
I mean, we'll see. So there's a lot of charities that work with refugees who are hoping that maybe the fire at Moria could be a turning point. Honestly, I don't think that will happen without more public pressure to do something significant about it. And that has to come from us. Like, I think people need to start caring more. And whether that means writing to your Member of Parliament or your MEP to demand that something changes, or maybe just starting to educate yourself a little bit more about Europe's refugee policy, whatever it is, like, I think the reason the status quo has continued for so long is because we've let it carry on.
Here in the Netherlands, I feel like there has been a bit of a shift. I've been noticing it, that people have been talking about it this last week, and there's been political pressure in a way that I don't see very often in the Netherlands, actually. I often feel like people are just like, yeah, the government can carry on doing what they want. And there were some like unusual voices in Parliament from the Christian Democratic Party and the coalition who were actually calling for the Netherlands to take more refugees. So that's my little hopeful tidbit.
On a brighter note, we have a new Patreon supporter to thank. Tell us who it is, Dominic.
Our latest Patreon supporter is Francesca Melandri, who, if you have a good memory, you will remember she was our guest last week, our wonderful, charismatic guest. So this is the first time one of our guests has then gone on to support us on Patreon. Thank you so much, Francesca, and thank you so much, everyone else who continues to support us. If you'd like to join Francesca, then head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. We are so grateful to our patrons and wouldn't still be doing this podcast if it wasn't for their monthly financial contributions. And we know it's a hard time financially for everyone right now, so don't feel pressured. But if you do happen to have a bit of spare cash for the equivalent of a coffee or two or three or four each
or
month
nine.
For us, then we'd be very grateful, and it will help secure the future of this podcast.
We've been pretty glued here at the Europeans to all the updates about what's been happening in Belarus, often referred to as Europe's last dictatorship, maybe for not much longer, given the massive uprising that we've seen in recent weeks against President Alexander Lukashenko.
I thought you were going to say maybe not for much longer because Hungary will join them. Sorry.
Grim.
Not funny. Sorry.
Back to Belarus. One of the most vital sources of information about what has been happening on the ground in Belarus, particularly amongst English speakers, has been the journalist Hanna Lyubakova. Her Twitter feed has become hugely important in gathering together all of these often frightening developments about protesters being kidnapped or tortured, but also these moments of huge courage and beauty on the streets at times. For her own safety, Hannah is unable to tell us where she is right now, but we were hugely privileged to get to speak to her at the end of last week. We did experience some technical issues, so you're going to hear a drop in sound quality about halfway through. Apologies for that, but we thought it was really important for you to hear what Hannah has to say. Over the past week or so, there's been a lot of arrests of prominent opposition members. Some of them have been kicked out of the country. The authorities are continuing with this very, very harsh crackdown. And it's a policy that seems to be an attempt to scare people into staying at home. But it doesn't seem to be working, does it?
I think that's what the authorities counted on, that they would scare people, they would hide at homes, they would stop protesting. But it doesn't happen for several reasons, I believe. Well, firstly, this kind of first response that the authorities made right after the election was just too harsh. Instead of scaring people, it made people angrier. These protests that are happening at the moment, they are against police brutality. They are against tortures and violence that happened. Instead of kind of scaring people, people came out to the streets to protest even more.
There's no sign of the protests abating yet, but is there any way in which you could see pressure increasing on Lukashenko? Because currently, he still seems to be holding on pretty firmly.
Lukashenko has been ignoring the protests for more than a month. In the first week especially, or like right after the election, especially when workers went on strike, when basically all social and professional groups started protesting, Lukashenko seemed to get scared. there was this moment of patience, of silence in a way, when people just, you know, were able to come out to the streets and like freely protest, I would say. But then he regained power, regained confidence. He called Vladimir Putin and he openly said so. He asked Putin for help, including military help. And what we know is that Putin promised to prepare a reserve of police officers and send to Belarus in case some like violations, some protests would be happening. So I think that's what made Lukashenko more confident. And that's why he feels stronger. At least he tries to create this impression. However, I wouldn't say that he is and will be strong in the long run because, well, in the first place, people don't stop protesting, right? People have a lot of reasons for their discontent. I mentioned this police brutality, but also these are economic reasons and so many reasons for people to not stop protesting. So this will not disappear. Even if Lukashenko will suppress the protests now, there will be a new wave. I can predict for sure. Obviously, there is pressure on him. Let's remember that, you know, protesters are tired, but also security forces members are tired. There were rumors that people at the general prosecutor office were not happy about how the police reacted. Some members resigned. So something is happening, and I'm sure there are different moods.
I've been really interested and happy to see women playing a massive role in this uprising. Politics has been a very patriarchal affair under Lukashenko. He sees women as weak. Do you think he underestimated his opponent partly because she is a woman?
Yes, that's true. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya was registered as a presidential candidate to create this impression that there are opposition candidates allowed on the ballot. That's what Lukashenko does. He doesn't allow strong opponents. He prefers to allow those kind of weaker ones. He doesn't consider women as rivals, as strong rivals. That's true. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya managed to unite people behind herself. She managed to unite the opposition, but also the whole population, basically. I've been traveling and I've been covering her rallies all across the country. And I saw that people come in thousands, dozens of thousands of people would come to her rallies. She has charisma. She managed to kind of motivate people, unite, mobilize people. But also it shows that people are pretty much ready to vote for a female leader and to elect a woman as president. And they basically did.
Along with her and various other women who are prominent in the opposition movement, there have been women, like a lot of women on the streets involved in the protests. Do you think that the way that society as a whole sees women in Belarus is also changing because of what's happening?
This is a popular uprising. This is a revolution of all people, of all social groups, of all ages. Mm-hmm. Women obviously made a huge difference when they began their all-female rallies. They wore white clothes, they held white flowers, and it all kind of worked as a contrast to how the police behaved. After that, women showed that they are able to protect men. And it's kind of a new quality. For the security forces, it's very hard to kind of react to beat them. However, it started happening. I thought that these rallies would be peaceful and the police would not react. But actually, police officers, riot police, started beating women as well. So it only delegitimizes these, you know, security forces, the police and the authorities all together. At the same time, the role of women would obviously change because Svetlana Tikhanovskaya and female trio were so successful, were so effective in uniting people, in actually kind of being politicians. So I think this stereotype that a woman cannot be a politician will definitely disappear after this summer, this campaign.
Is there some disappointment among the resistance at the relatively slow pace of the international response to these protests? I know you said that Lithuania have now recognized Tikhanovskaya as their president-elect, but the EU itself, they've been very rhetorically strong, but not much has actually happened yet.
I think there is an expectation among the people in Belarus, among protesters, that the West would react more, that they would impose more pressure on Lukashenko. What I think the West is lacking is unified, clear position. There were very powerful announcements from the Baltic states, but what I think is not happening is that the European Union is not united in their position. So this is what the people would expect. And yes, I think it's crucial to show them that they are not left alone. Let's remember that these are peaceful protests. People exercise their constitutional rights. They demand justice. And they did everything, like, legally.
What can that pressure look like? Because there's been a lot of talk about sanctions. The EU already had sanctions on Belarus before this election, things like asset freezes and travel bans on certain people. And it didn't stop Lukashenko from carrying on with this crackdown. To what extent do you think sanctions are proving like a useful weapon in putting pressure on the regime?
Well, again, this is not my role to kind of to lobby pro or against sanctions. But I can say that previously, economic sanctions, especially individual sanctions against those people who were involved in vote rigging or brutal reaction, detaining people, did work. These bans, this list of people who are not allowed to the EU or their assets have been frozen, actually scared businessmen, scared those people who support Lukashenko.
What's it been like for you personally covering this incredibly turbulent and violent but also optimistic time in your country? It must be a lot to deal with watching these videos and having to share them with the world.
Well, it was really dangerous, especially in the first days. It was kind of dangerous to be outside even. We were driving, you know, our car, and stun grenades were exploding, and journalists, my colleagues, were targeted with rubber bullets. What I think is scary is that there are no rules. Basically, if you are a journalist, you have all this kind of press vest, identification signs on yourself, and it will not protect you. Even more, you can be targeted because, you know, you are a journalist. So this is something you don't know really how to behave. And whether you should say that you're a journalist or you should hide. And basically, that's what I did. I did both. But I think what's also different right now is that people appreciate the role of journalists. They really respect their work. You can see that during protests, people literally defend journalists. They prevent them from being detained. And it really kind of makes me hopeful as a journalist, as someone who work as a reporter on the streets, that, you know, this kind of trust in independent information, this respect, this admiration, basically, for media, actually, as long as, you know, in other countries, trust in journalism is declining. I think it's absolutely different trend in Belarus, where, you know, journalists are being, independent journalists are being respected even more. That's what I think brings a lot of hope as well.
Thank you, Hannah, for taking the time to speak to us in your busy, busy schedule at the moment. We'll put a link to her Twitter profile in our show notes. She's really worth following. And I know it's natural for us to all stop, notice what's going on in a crisis like this once it's stopped appearing at the top of our headlines, just like the Moria crisis. But by following Hannah and other brave Belarusian reporters, we can keep the eyes of the world on what's going on. So do that.
It's time for Isolation Inspiration. What have you been reading, listening to, otherwise consuming this week, Dominic?
I listened to the BBC podcast series called The Missing Crypto Queen.
Oh, yeah. Again, late to the party.
I know, really late to the party. And I'd kind of just decided, no, I'm not going to listen to that. And then
it's too popular.
I was painting my windows and listened to it all. If you haven't listened yet, it's a fascinating and really beautifully told story, real life story about a cryptocurrency called OneCoin, which turns out to be a scam, spoiler alert, and about the woman in charge of that, a Bulgarian woman called Ruja Ignatova. It's a really mysterious story. Did you like it?
I thought it was absolutely wild, and I enjoyed it greatly. At the same time, I was feeling really horrible about all of these people that got sucked in by this awful, awful scam. It's just crazy.
Yeah, it's really sad. Have you been watching or listening something more jolly?
Not more jolly, but definitely really interesting. I've got a bit of a controversial pick for Isolation Inspiration this week, which is a French film called Mignonne. You might have heard about it this week under its English name, Cuties. And that's because there's been a wave of opposition to this film, mostly amongst American conservatives, saying that it promotes the sexualization of young girls. And the outrage over all of this has spawned its own hashtag, which you might have seen, Cancel Netflix. Have you been following this?
No, it's completely passed me by.
Aha, then I'll tell you all about it. The film is about an 11-year-old Senegalese girl living in Paris called Ami. She comes from a quite strict religious family, and it's about her joining this dance group, kind of TikTok-style dancing, I guess. And if you have spent time on that particular application, you'll definitely have come across these like really uncomfortable videos of very young girls doing this kind of sexy dancing. Are you a TikTok person?
Well, I did learn about TikTok on this podcast about 2 years ago. I remember that moment. You taught me
not
about
good.
It. I actually wanted to join during lockdown, but my husband forbade me.
Aww.
Because it's an evil company. His words, not mine. Don't sue him.
Oh, thanks. Here comes the lawsuit. Back to this film. It's basically a critique of the sexualization of preteen girls. And as soon as you watch the film, that's pretty obvious. It's been out in French cinemas for a few weeks now, and it's been getting pretty good reviews. And the filmmaker Maimouna Doucouré has talked about how it's kind of drawn on her own experiences as a kid born in a Senegalese family in France and feeling kind of caught between two cultures. On the one side, there's one that like requires women to be very demure. And on the other side, she's got one that requires women to be sexual objects in extremis. And it's a really thoughtful and sensitive film, I think. However, there has been this massive fuss about it in the English-speaking world this week, mostly in America, because the film came out on US Netflix and quite a lot of people don't seem to get it. A lot of the people who are outraged about it also don't seem to have seen the film at all. They've only seen a promo image for the film that shows these girls in very sexy clothing. And now a lot of American conservatives seem to think it's a film promoting child pornography, which is definitely not the case.
Ugh. So I should watch it.
Yep.
I should ignore all the influence I get from the American conservatives.
I mean, I will leave you to make up your mind as to whether you think it glorifies the sexualization of young girls or not. It's definitely not the intention, and I think it's really worth watching anyway. It's in French cinemas now, or if you have access to a US Netflix account, or maybe a VPN, it's out there too.
My happy ending this week is maybe more a really weird story than a happy story.
Again?
Yeah, and it comes from Verviers in Belgium, where builders were recently doing some renovation works on a fountain in the city. And during their digging and drilling, they found a metal box underneath one of the stones.
Oh, is this like in Amelie where it's like filled with childhood delights or something?
I never saw Amelie. I'm the only person. I know the soundtrack.
You can watch it and recommend it as another very late to the party recommendation next week.
The box contained an inscription on it. And inside the box was a glass jar filled with ethanol and a human heart.
Oh, I was not expecting that.
I did warn you it would be weird.
Whose heart was it? Do we know?
It was the heart of a former mayor of the city. In fact, the first person to be mayor of the city after Belgium became an independent country, which was in...
Ooh.
No, I'm kidding. You, of course, you're not going to know. 1830. His name was Pierre David, and he seems to have been pretty popular. Locally, he opened the first fire brigade and was the first person to allow the citizens to attend council debates. His heart really belonged to the city, you could say. And, well, it turns out that his heart literally still belongs to the city and has been beneath this fountain since he tragically died in 1839 after falling out of a building.
Oh, God.
There had been rumours that his heart was buried under this fountain, which was built in his memory. But a councillor, a local councillor of today, told Reuters that no one really believed it.
Oh.
Now we have conclusive proof that it exists, weirdly, and it will be placed back under the fountain once the work is completed. But for now, it has been taken to the Verviers Museum of Fine Arts and Ceramics for the locals to see.
That's going to look nice nestled amongst all the local ceramics, the human heart.
Where would you like to have your heart buried, Katie?
Oh, I was thinking about this the other day. And
really?
Yeah, well, my boyfriend and I were talking about like where we might like our ashes scattered.
Oh, okay.
Bit morbid, I know. And we decided we'd like a bit scattered in each of our favourite fast food establishments.
Oh.
One at the kebab shop down the road in Paris. One at Domino's in London. You know the drill.
Oh, classy.
Where do you want yours buried?
Well, I actually just opted this week into the new organ donation scheme in the Netherlands. Oh. So no fountains for me.
Way to make me feel like a terrible person.
It was a trap.
That's it for this week. Next week, we're going to be talking to the German historian Simon Strauss about, among other things, romanticism. We could do with a bit of that, I think.
We could. And we're speaking to him because he's taking part in the Forum on European Culture, which, just to remind you, is taking place this week and the weekend. So go check out their schedule for what I'm sure will be a riveting series of events looking at the future of Europe.
I've never heard anyone use the word riveting, like, non-ironically.
Really?
Yeah, but you do mean it's going to be genuinely riveting, don't you?
I do. And I actually often have a thing with my voice where people think I'm being ironic and I'm not.
It's called being British.
You can check us out on social media where we're sometimes ironic. On Twitter, we... what's our account called? At Europeans Pod.
Yes.
Instagram, Europeans Podcast. You can find us on Facebook if you type in the Europeans Podcast. And you can email us hello@europeanspodcast.com.
Well done.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye.